Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen, and for new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And this is going to be the culmination of the 2017 year of Women of Color on this podcast. And I'm very happy to have Vashti Harrison on here, who is the illustrator and author of Little Leaders, Bold Women in Black History, which by the time this episode airs should be out. It comes out December 5th, yes? Mm-hmm. And the excitement that has abounded on my timeline when I posted that I got an early copy of this book was intense. So we have a lot to discuss because you are, I don't know if it's fair to call you a woman of all trades, but you have very specific backgrounds of where you picked up your art, mm-hmm. and it wasn't necessarily something you went to school for, if that's accurate to say.
If we were looking at my
strictly academic
transcripts, you would have no idea what I would end up studying, mm-hmm. because I jumped around a lot. Art was always something I was really passionate about, but I had never considered it a real career. So it wasn't until I was kind of floundering in college that I really decided that, okay, this is what I am. I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. Now I need to decide what kind of art do I want to make. Mm-hmm. And when I made that decision, it was right around the time that I'd taken my first film class. And it was just a class that I didn't have any intentions of taking or really enjoying. Everyone at the University of Virginia has to take an English writing requirement. And because every first year student has to do this, they offer a million different options. You can take an English writing requirement where you write 5 papers and the class can have the theme of the war or politics or Disney movies. And the one that I ended up being in was called America Through Film. And that was my first film class, and it was this thing that kind of like a light bulb went off. It was this amazing way of thinking about art and cinema, and I realized that I've been thinking about the world and my storytelling in this kind of cinematic fashion. So I felt like, okay, if I'm going to study art, I'm going to study film. So I had plans to transfer to film school, but I ended up staying at the University of Virginia, and I became an art major with a double major in media studies. My main curriculum was studying cinema and cinematography, but I was taking a bunch of other drawing classes and printmaking and digital art. And by the time I was about to graduate, I thought that if I'm really going to try to make this experimental film thing work, I really want to go get my graduate degree in it. I did a fellowship in the year after college, and then I went to California Institute of the Arts for grad school to get my MFA in film. My entry into the film world was always from this kind of artistic experimental avenue. The best way I can kind of explain it is that experimental filmmakers are artists who work with film. That just happens to be their medium.
Okay.
Whereas some artists paint, some artists are sculptors, experimental filmmakers, or what maybe you call a film artist, is an artist that just works with film. There are only a handful of schools to really study that in the United States, and I ended up going to one of the best ones, California Institute of the Arts, and that school is famous for not its film program, but its animation program, which was founded by Walt Disney. So everyone gets really excited when they hear CalArts, and then I went to CalArts, and it's like, no, I wasn't in that program. But it's really impressive, and if I applied, I don't think I would be able to get in. So I took every opportunity while I was in art school to take as many classes in every department as possible, and especially the animation department.
It's interesting that you say that you didn't consider illustration something that you could pursue, but film was something?
I think there was a transition that happened in college. So when I was in high school, I had a very specific idea of what a career could be. And for me, it was like, become a lawyer.
Those kind of stable jobs.
And yeah. So when I got to college, the very first year, my first semester, I was floundering. I took like an intro to political and social thought, an economics class, a French class. I thought it was going to be a foreign affairs and French major or a political science kind of major. And I hated all of the classes. And it was just like one saving grace was I took an art history class. And that was like the gateway drug to be like, okay, you really want to study art. This transition happened as I got a little bit older. Like, okay, once I've decided that I want to make art, and I realized that film was a viable possibility. I feel like in the mainstream, it's a lot easier for someone to imagine themselves with a career in the film world than in the art world. And mm-hmm. as an experimental filmmaker, you learn the tools of the trade, mm-hmm. And you learn the language of making cinema, Hollywood style cinema. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I thought that it might be a possibility for me to kind of get a job in the film industry while still making my own art films in mm-hmm. my spare time. Mm-hmm. And by the time I finished grad school, I was still kind of on that path. One mm-hmm. of my first jobs after graduating was working on an animated TV series as a production coordinator. Mm-hmm. That was what I thought, because I could sustain myself by going to work and having a day job and then working on my film stuff at home. And that kind of worked. Like, the films that I made in grad school and kind of finished afterwards, they were showing in lots of film festivals, and I would get to travel. And, you know, some of them are still showing in festivals. One is showing on Friday mm-hmm. in New Orleans. So that was the idea that I thought would be able to work for mm-hmm. myself, take time off to go create things in my own, in the quiet, and then, you know, have a steady day job. Although that didn't quite stay my main trajectory, because what I was actually doing at home after work, instead of working on films, was drawing. Mm-hmm. And that was also the gateway drug to something, to creating a career in illustrating. So I feel like it's a little bit muddled. It's a little bit confusing, my story. Like, basically what happened was, while I was in grad school taking these film classes, I really just wanted something for fun. And because I knew that I had all, you know, I was paying a lot of money to go to this school, I was going to take every opportunity to take other fun classes. And so in my final year, I started taking these drawing classes mm-hmm. in the animation department. And the thing that really got me going was, I was not very good. I drew a lot as a teenager. I drew enough while I was in college to do my intro requirement classes. But once I started making films, I really stopped drawing entirely.
Really?
So there was probably a solid 6 to 8 years where I was not doing any drawing.
At all?
At all. Let's say fall 2013, spring 2014, when I was taking those drawing classes, and I was like, I really love this, but I hate that I'm not good anymore. and then that program, that animation program, is an undergraduate program. So there are a lot of like 18, 17, 19-year-old kids who get hired by Disney before their second year, you know? So I was like, these kids are so good, and I want to be this good, so I'm just going to work on this. Mm-hmm. So while I was finishing up my thesis film, after I graduated, after I had my first couple of jobs after grad school, I was just going home and drawing all night. So mm-hmm. that whole idea of working on films in my spare time kind of got pushed to the side, because this was another type of creative process that could feel... Well, like, it was satisfying in this way that I could start and finish something in a night, whereas a film takes years, months.
Yeah.
To finish. So it was satisfying this creative urge within me a little bit more than filmmaking at the time. Mm. And so it just superseded my interests at the time. And then while I was working on that animated TV show, I would go home and draw all night. Mm. And then the show got canceled and I got laid off. And I needed to figure out what I was going to do. I'd moved from LA to Atlanta to work on this show.
And were your roots in California?
No. Mm-hmm. But, you know, everyone says go to the grad school where you want to meet your connections, mm-hmm. where you want to make your network. And so it felt like a big choice to leave LA at the time mm-hmm. for a job in Atlanta. But I felt like I was following the trend. It seemed like a lot of people were moving there, especially mm-hmm. in the film industry. And it's like a hotbed for talent, like for creative work. So I thought I was making a very smart choice, and I was really happy with it. So I was kind of blindsided when I got laid off and I didn't know what to do next. During this time, I was still doing film stuff, and it was just this kind of crazy moment of being laid off and knowing that I had this film festival, a film market to go to, where I was going to pitch a movie to a series of producers. So yeah. I had this month of being like, okay, I think I'm just going to go home to my parents' house, prepare for this movie thing, and I'm just going to go there, and then we'll see what happens afterwards. And yeah. that was like, it was just enough time to make me feel like, I'm not going back to Atlanta. I'm going to move back home with my parents. Mm-hmm. It didn't make sense for me to go back at that time, because I wasn't able to find more work. I moved home with my parents and I didn't know what was going to happen next. But mm-hmm. What I really knew that I wanted was a creative job. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to be very creative as a production coordinator on that show.
Oh, really?
Not at all, really. My job was to make sure everyone had their assignments and that production was running smoothly on the animation end. So I would create spreadsheets and track everyone's progress.
So it was like a managerial.
Exactly. Every once in a while, I would like sneak my ideas in, like, hey, guys, maybe you should try this out. But it was this weird feeling of not being able to be creative mm-hmm. for 10 hours a day at work and then going home and drawing at night. And no one, really not too many of the people I was working with, any of the animators, knew that I was drawing, mm-hmm. that I had this whole secret thing that was going on. I had my Instagram account. And it was under a different name at the time.
Oh, was it?
And I
really?
Was just posting stuff.
You were all incognito.
Yeah, I felt really insecure about my drawing. Mm-hmm. After not having drawn for 8 years, after going to that and taking classes with these really talented teenagers, mm-hmm. and then working in animation with talented animators and mm-hmm. artists, I felt like I'm just a nobody. Yeah. I'm not ready to release this into the world. So in 2015, the fall, that I decided to move home and pursue a creative career. And what I really thought that meant was I really wanted to work in books, but I had no interest in illustrating books. I was like, I want to be a book designer.
Oh, so okay. Like do covers or
I wanted to
as well.
Design the layouts and the interiors of books.
Oh, typesetter, fellow typesetter.
and I liked book design and book covers, but because I was so insecure about my drawing ability, I had no confidence that I could be an illustrator, especially not children's book illustrator. Mm-hmm. Like 32 pages full of my illustrations? Whew, I didn't think that was possible.
Full spreads? Ugh. God, no.
So I did all these interviews with like Macmillan, mm-hmm. and I didn't get any of those jobs. So I had come up to New York to do all those interviews, and I was like really prepared to just be somewhere having a creative job. I didn't get anything. It didn't work out. So I officially moved home, officially in March 2016.
Oh, okay.
And during this time, I had taken my first commissioned illustration. I was really nervous about it.
Mm-hmm. So at this time, like 2016, you have been drawing again for what, 3 years at that point, or a couple years?
Just about 2 years.
Two years.
Let's say 2.5 years. Two and a half years mm-hmm. in the secret of night.
Still under incognito?
Under wraps, yeah. But I had taken a couple of commissions and I was like, okay, this is making me some money. So maybe mm-hmm. I should just go home and try to make this a real career. So it wasn't until that moment, March 2016, where I was like, okay, I'm going to go home and try to be an illustrator. And I joined the SCBWI.
Yeah.
And I started doing a ton of research. And even though I was like terrified about it, I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to try to do it.
Okay.
I joined the group and then I submitted a drawing to one of their competitions. I guess it was in May 2016. Mm-hmm. It's only like 2 months into it. I submitted the drawing for the competition. It got selected as a winner for the competition.
What?
And it got placed into the monthly newsletter that went out on June 1st, 2016.
I have to look because I might have that newsletter.
You might. On like June 2nd, I got an offer to illustrate a book from an art director at Simon & Schuster. I was like, uh-oh, this is real. So even though like that's such a Cinderella story, I was still terrified. I was like, mm-hmm. I don't know if I can do this, but I'm going to try because this is it. This is what I said I was going to do. And then it really just snowballed from there. I went to an SCBWI conference, the Mid-Atlantic conference, because I was living in Virginia. And that's where I met my agent. And that was in October 2016.
Wow. So this is really snowball effect.
Yeah. And then I did a book cover. And then I got an offer to do 2 more books. I moved to New York in December 2016. And then in February 2017, I decided I was going to do this series of illustrations for Black History Month.
Mm-hmm.
And halfway into February, I asked my agent if she thought there was a book possibility here. Mm-hmm. And she was like, yeah, I was going to ask you what you thought. And we pitched it. And then in March 2017, I had a deal at Little Brown for a 3-book deal.
Wow.
So I don't know if anyone can tell, but I'm still like, I'm the imposter over here. I don't know how this happened to me so quickly. I'm
and
still
in that
terrified.
Time, we got thousands and thousands of followers on Instagram and a huge fan base in that time.
Yeah. So I was just steady posting stuff on Instagram at that time because they didn't know that I didn't believe myself to be a true illustrator. So they were the ones that were like, I love your art. Can mm-hmm. you draw me? Can you mm-hmm. do commissions? And I was like, I can't do this. Who do you think I am? I hold my followers on Instagram very dear to my heart because they are the ones that treated me like a mm-hmm. like a professional long before I ever considered myself one. And mm-hmm. That was the platform through which I was getting the bits of work that I did have when mm-hmm. I felt completely lost. I didn't know what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I was getting rejected from job after job. So yeah, it's kind of crazy that I'm at like 30,000 followers, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. the women that support me are so supportive. Yeah. I don't know how to express it even more, but yeah. I wrote a special part for them in the acknowledgments mm-hmm. of Little Leaders because they're the most supportive people. I love it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like not just because we are Black women, but you know, the Black female fan base is known to be the highest consumers of books, mm-hmm. but also the most dedicated. Mm-hmm. That, like what you're saying, when we are fans of something, I feel like we're diehard fans mm-hmm. to the end, unless something really bad comes out.
Like, but in that way, you can trust them. Like I would anything that is recommended or highly supported by that group of people, mm-hmm. I would trust because mm-hmm. I know that they don't support something that they don't believe in. So.
That's true. Money where our mouths are. So, wow, that I did not realize it was that fast.
Yeah.
Trivia.
That's why I'm constantly like, are you sure? Are you sure you want to put author, illustrator? Like,
you did type the words.
I did. No, I mean, I did write the book. It just like, it feels, the title author to me feels so big. Mm. I mean, illustrator feels so big. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. some people spend their whole lives illustrating, going to school for illustrating. Some people go to school and get their MFAs in creative writing. And I have my degree in filmmaking. I feel yeah. very comfortable with the term filmmaker. So I feel like a little bit nervous about author illustrator because it feels like it's happened so fast. A lot of, you know, because I felt like I put in so much time and effort into learning film. I think it's just, you know, a personal thing that I... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it's happened so quickly, it's mm. not a part of the way I think about it yet. I don't know.
That's interesting. Because I feel also some writers, depending on who you ask, they could get all the degrees, and unless they win a freaking Pulitzer, they don't feel like a writer. Yeah. So I guess it kind of varies.
I think
a lot
it's
of ways.
Part of just the creative process. I'm sure mm. you'll run into painters and sculptors that feel similarly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to this, what you said when you went to those classes mm-hmm. and you were looking at all these other people and you say, this sucks. What I'm doing sucks. I'm not happy with what I'm producing right now. Was it that joy in the process that kept you going? Were you finding joy in the process, mm-hmm. even though you were, it seems like you were struggling to get to a yeah. point you were happy with?
That's a good question. I feel like a lot of illustrators or artists might run into this. Maybe it's because one of the biggest misconceptions about people who draw is that drawing is easy for them. But drawing is always hard. It'll always be hard. Mm-hmm. So there's this really satisfying part of creating something. But I think once you start comparing yourself to other people, that's when it can get really, really frustrating. So that was probably a big part of the difficulties at the beginning. But yeah, I think the process is always satisfying. For me, mm-hmm. it's just, you know, sometimes things don't come out the way you want them to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, I think that's inherent to mm-hmm. any creative process.
Okay. Can you speak a little about Hair Love at all? That's working with Matthew Cherry on that? Mm-hmm. Or is that kind of under wraps since the Kickstarter campaign? And the Kickstarter campaign got obliterated. All those goals got blown out of the water.
Yeah, so I can talk about how Matthew and I connected. It was through the beauty of social media. But I had known about Matthew. We both showed films at the Black Star Film Festival in 2016. 16. Mm-hmm. So I saw his film there and I saw him speak. He was certainly like on my radar of people in the orbit.
Was he also doing experimental film?
No, he had a narrative short in that festival. Okay. And I was showing an experimental short. That's actually one of my favorite film festivals to show at. Mm-hmm. Because it's a festival for and about Black people. And typically there aren't, you don't find experimental film categories at every film festival. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that they provide that mm-hmm. that category there. So that's a meeting place for an experimental filmmaker and a narrative filmmaker who's an ex-football player. Under normal circumstances, we may not have crossed paths, but I appreciate Black Star Film Festival for making that happen. The community of kind of indie Black filmmakers feels a little bit small. So he had seen a drawing of mine that I did of a friend who went to CalArts with me, and she mm-hmm. was in the directing program. And then he reached out about doing artwork for the Kickstarter. He shared with me a little bit about the story and the process and everything that he wanted, and I kind of got the picture immediately. I knew exactly what he wanted, and I thought, like, I have the opportunity here to draw something in the style, in my style. Mm-hmm. I have an opportunity to bring something more creative to the table in terms of ways of illustrating girls. But I knew that the thing that would connect with people is creating a character that looked like a mainstream kind of like Disney style character, because we don't get to see mm-hmm. little Black girls mm-hmm. like that very often. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I should pull from the repertoire and try to make this mm-hmm. kind of as punchy as possible. And the same thing with the dad. I really wanted to make him this kind of big hulking character that yeah, feels
kind of alpha male looking, like, if it's fair.
Almost like yeah. a, like, what do you call it? Like a lovable giant. Is that yeah. what you call it? There's an idiom for that.
Yeah. Well, it's also reminded me, because he is such a hulking character, like kind of like Moana.
A little bit. I just thought that there would be these really sweet moments of like a big guy trying to do something really tiny and dainty. And I yeah. think that there's a lot of humor yeah. and beauty in that.
Yeah,
I really wanted to create these really striking characters that would make people say, I want to see that movie. Mm-hmm. And so that was the main goal, to just make content for the Kickstarter campaign.
So that's under wraps, but it's happening, because it's so cute. I love it. I wanted to ask also about misconceptions, because I haven't had a lot of illustrators. I've had you on, Nyla Magruder, another SCBWI person who is now blown up as well. Mary Naomi, who's a cartoonist. And there's these misconceptions, like you said, of people thinking art is easy. Illustration, I don't think it's easy. I actually think it's way harder. Considering I am horrible and I could just do stick figures. Also because of the way art is judged, and I wonder if it's judged more harshly in a way that writing is not. Or maybe it's not fair. It's apples and oranges in a way. But what do you think are some misconceived notions about the illustration process?
Well, I feel like on my end, the thing that people always seem shocked about is that even if you are like a talented, trained artist, that you can still struggle. It's always going to be hard. It's hard for even the most talented people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I feel like I get what you're saying and I agree with it. But I also feel sometimes when someone isn't an artist, they are so supportive of the artwork mm-hmm. in a way that I'm always like, oh no, don't you see all the mistakes and the flaws? And they're mm-hmm. like, no, it's beautiful. It's yeah, great. It's yeah. perfect. And I'm like, no. Yeah, perhaps it's because I'm coming from the perspective of an artist and a perfectionist that mm. I am always nervous about how good I could have made something. Mm-hmm. But it's true that people will make judgments really quickly about a book based on the style. But I don't find that to be a problem, because I want someone to enjoy the book that they are reading and mm-hmm. and looking at 100%. To judge a book by its illustration alone is mm-hmm. not fair. But also to mm-hmm. judge a book by its writing alone is also equally mm-hmm. unfair, because I believe a true picture book is a beautiful marriage of text and image. That's so true. If the style of illustration isn't working for you, I wouldn't, as a very visual person, I wouldn't force anyone mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. try to enjoy it. Because mm-hmm. I think that for me, it makes a big difference.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So with Little Leaders, Bold Women in Black History, there's so many things to it because automatically, and I was wondering if how it came to be was due to your Instagram mm-hmm. thing in February. So mm-hmm. hearing that, that's how it came about was really amazing. But also hearing you say you're a perfectionist and if you're seeing flaws, were you, in terms of the marriage of this book, mm-hmm. which is all you pretty much, were you also doing the background that the characters are in? Was it really you're doing the just the illustrations of the women and then that's when Little Brown comes in and they say, hey, we're going to do this background and this is how we're going to put these, you know, this is how we're going to preface her name mm-hmm. and do these chapter heads and all these beautiful things. So was that kind of a marriage in a way, or was it, you just saw it later?
No. Little Brown was very, very supportive about everything that I wanted to do. And because mm-hmm. I am such a perfectionist, I wanted to have my hand in every single thing.
Really?
So, I'd seen a couple samples of the cover, and mm-hmm. I was like, this looks good, but let's try it like this. I'd really like to add these laurels. I really want these five women, and I want them organized this way, and I want them on this I put them on a pale background, on a white background,
and
they suggested a cream, and so that's the kind of conversations okay. we had. But otherwise, every single part of it was my decision. The doodles in the background were something that I think had been thinking about while I was still working on the Black History Month project. So I wanted a way to distinguish the book from mm-hmm. the Instagram pictures, mm-hmm. So I didn't include that in the ones that people can see online. But there was I kind of developed a visual language. I knew that the little leaders themselves would be illustrated in this particular way with a set of brushes that I use and render out their clothes in this particular way. And then I wanted the backgrounds to have this kind of almost like doodles in this way that they're the ideas of a background. Mm-hmm, if you can imagine yourself to be Bessie Coleman, these are the imagined clouds that you would be flying through, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Originally, they were going to continue throughout, but kind of midway through creating the artwork, I really thought that it would be prudent to isolate the illustration and the doodles mostly to the right-hand side of the spread mm-hmm. and then make sure that the text is the most important part of the left-hand side mm-hmm. of the spread. I've redesigned all the doodles to go up and above the title name. The team at Little Brown was just like really, really supportive in helping me figure out the best way to do something. Mm-hmm. So like I would provide for them the assets and they would say, okay, here's how you should move it around. But I designed every part of it. Something in particular that I knew that I wanted was this spread of extra women in the mm-hmm. back, and I was curious about how many they thought I could fit into a page and how long the mini bios could, how many words I could fit there. So that was a conversation that we had together, but I created the artwork and then they helped me resize it to fit through there, and then we kind of designed the whole page mm. to fit around. But it was an interesting challenge because I like to be able to see everything together, so it was really a little bit difficult for me to write all of the bios and do all the research and then do all of the art. In theory, it would have been nice to be able to see everything together. Yeah. So they had the text for the bios and had them formatted, and yeah. I didn't get to see them in the spreads for a really long time. So that was little bit, because everything had to be done in pieces, it felt a little bit terrifying, but it all came together in this really great way. And the designer, who's like the art director at Little Brown, Dave Kaplan, who's like a master, he created this like master file that everything could pop into very nicely. So when I had like last minute changes and I said, no, these doodles don't work at all, he handled them amazingly.
God!
we had like long conversations about the end papers, and mm-hmm. I had done a couple styles that had multiple colors, and they told me how they typically do end papers and how nice end papers are done. So that was a conversation we had about doing the one color, mm-hmm. the tone on tone instead of a multicolor, because mm-hmm. we have different paper options. So it was a lot of technical stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which was really nice because, again, I really like designing books, and that's the stuff I get really nervous. Nerdy about. So I had an idea of what a beautiful book could be. So it was really nice to be able to see how it all comes together with people who have, you know, designed books for a living.
Yeah. And it did come together nicely. I did not realize that much. Because I know how much work goes into a book, but wow.
Yeah, honestly, the little leaders themselves were the easiest part.
Because they were technically, most of them were done. Technically, is that accurate?
Not really.
No.
Because I don't know if most people noticed this. I didn't actually finish my Black History Month project. I couldn't get them all done in time. It was just an overwhelming amount of work, and I was days and days behind. But people were really supportive, and very fortunately, Women's History Month is right after Black History Month, so they were very forgiving with me not being able to post every single day. But the process of creating the little leaders in their costumes was something that's very, I'm very comfortable with. Like, I can do the rendering really quick. But the thing that took the longest was deciding what would go in the backgrounds, because I thought that they needed to be accurate to each person's story and they needed to be designed well, but also look effortless. Mm-hmm. And so that in and of itself is a very complicated process. So for, let's say, Bessie Coleman, for example, oh, even Augusta Savage, the background for her, I created like her studio, and I recreated some of her most famous sculptures. And I, you know, it was really important that they look accurate.
Yeah.
And they're recognizable. I needed to scale them accurately, and they needed to be the right design. And, you know, that for me is even more complicated than anything else. Because I want a kid, or I want anyone to be able to look at this book, read it, and then come back to it and discover new things. So the little doodles that you'll see above the names, those are all specific to each person's story. Yep. And they're like tiny little Easter eggs if you look closely. Like Sojourner Truth has this quote about when she says that when she's gone, I'm going to be a shooting star after she's passed away. And so there's a shooting star in one of her in the little doodles about her name, and doesn't say that in her bio. But if you were to go on and do more research, you might be able to find that. So there's a lot of like tiny little tidbits that I wanted to populate the book with.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask about the construction also? Mm-hmm. Because for the most part, not all of them, but some have profiles, a lot of them are face forward. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to call it the base, even if that's inaccurate, because they're closing their eyes. Mm-hmm. For the most part. And then you're noticing like different tones, different outfits, hair and stuff like that. So did you conceivably start with quote unquote a base and then go from there to make things quote unquote easier?
Yeah. So
rather than make every face kind of just like structurally exact in terms of.
Yeah, it was almost like a template, honestly. Mm-hmm. So I worked on one that I felt like this is going to be my base. Little leader, and then I moved on from there. I really wanted you to be able to flip the pages and for it to look like a flip book, like there's just one little leader and she's just changing her outfit. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted them to seem interchangeable, like you could be any one of these girls.
But also identifiable, because when you see Angela Davis, when you see Julie, when you see all these other characters, you're like, oh, that is them. Mm-hmm. And can I also comment that the hair looks very good, because I was having a talk with a friend and she had her book cover done by a non-Black woman. I think the woman was white, and I'm again not trying to say oh white and Black or blah, blah, blah. But the way she did Black hair was just kind of this messy kind of attempt at braids, and it just was not working. It looked very thick and chunky and just kind of, you know, just badly done. And in yours, again, it's not to say that you go into these specific details of, oh, let's see how a plait is done, but the afro and especially Julie's hair. Like, I was looking with a coworker at just the specificity of
Julie's
hair. Yeah, you know, you could see it's just like, okay, this looks realistic.
Yeah.
Or even with Hair Love, I was looking very closely. Obviously, it's about Black hair, but the vlogger, her hair was just shiny and it had that body. And I said, that's Black hair. Mm-hmm. Black hair is not difficult to do. Natural hair is not difficult. So I just wonder about kind of like those aesthetics learned.
Yeah. So I really like rendering hair. Mm-hmm. So for me, I wanted, if these were like the best cosplayers in the world, they would get it right. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that and also it's like really fun for me. So I just wanted to spend a lot of time thinking about it, because the little leaders themselves, their bodies and their skin, there's not a lot of rendering there. So I can use the hair and the clothing as the thing that can make this pop. Mm-hmm. And then the backgrounds are all almost flat. So yeah. I felt like that's my opportunity. I really like doing the rendering and mm-hmm. making things look like real leather and things look like real hair. And then in a lot of the cases, like Julie Dash's hair is the thing that I know the most about her. Mm-hmm. I could pick Julie Dash out of a crowd because her hair is so iconic. Same mm-hmm. thing with Angela Davis. Mm-hmm. And
in, I mean, Oprah's changes.
I think about it like costumes. If you were mm-hmm. going to dress up as someone for a costume party, mm-hmm. you would choose like the most iconic moment or an mm-hmm. amalgam of their most iconic moments. Mm-hmm. So for someone like Oprah, who is probably the most contemporary, biggest name in the book, I didn't choose a specific outfit. I designed an outfit and I designed mm-hmm. her hair and mm-hmm. I chose like a mixture of the different glasses that she wears mm-hmm. to bring it all together. So it was just about looking and kind of mm-hmm. absorbing the information that's available mm-hmm. about them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not so funny because one of my questions for you was, I spoke with Pat Cumming. She's a veteran illustrator. She teaches at Pratt, I believe. And she mentioned that as an instructor, what she's observed is that there's this fear from her students to render, especially people of color, because there's a worry about exoticizing or, you know, kind of stereotyping and things like that. So she said that that could be an explanation for why we see so many animals in picture books. Because I could bring out those stats that there are more animals in picture books than children of color, yeah. But I won't. But it was just interesting to hear from her, as from the instructor point of, she would give someone, she literally gave someone criticism and said, well, your Asian American is looking kind of, you know, something racist, but she didn't say racist.
Yeah.
And so they came back and did a bear. Mm. And that wasn't a fix. That was their fix. You know, it was just like, well, rather than try, I'll just do something I know I can't fuck up, so to speak. So I wonder, from your point as a illustrator and a woman of color creating this, do those kind of thoughts or identities, or kind of how to render identities, comes into your mind of, okay, I want to make a black girl and this is why I want to make her? Because you mentioned Disney and having this kind of like, I've seen, you know, your princesses, and the more recent one I saw of a boy sitting on top of a pile of books, and mm-hmm. your aesthetic is identifiable, I feel like, but it also kind of reconciles with other kind of ideologies in a way, especially when it comes into art.
First, I want to touch on the point made by Pat Cummings. I feel like the thing that illustrators can do when they're worried about exoticizing a character and creating characters that are not, you know, from their own background, mm-hmm. is to be honest to them. One of my favorite things about writing and about storytelling is creating the world and living in the world that your protagonist lives in. So if I'm going to write a story about a girl from South Korea, I'm not going to just, I don't know, base it off of something that I've seen on TV. I'm going to do mm-hmm. the research about the neighborhood that I believe that she comes from, and mm-hmm. then try to be honest to that character, not mm-hmm. to other people, not to other representations of that people, but mm-hmm. to the person that I believe she is. And I think that like really great writers, really great screenwriters are successful when they do that, when mm-hmm. they're really thoughtful about the choices that they're making as they relate to the story. So I feel like in the scenario of people being worried about exoticizing, you know, particularly black people in illustrations, mm-hmm. I would just try to be honest to a true representation of that character that you think you're creating. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to simplify the illustrations of the women in my book because it's easy cut corners in doing the hair, because I feel like, one, the hair is important to mm-hmm. in terms of creating a costume. I feel like the hair is this like a singular point that helps really sell a character. So I really want it to be honest to the person I'm trying to represent. So it feels like you don't have to try to answer all the questions. You don't have mm-hmm. to try to cover all representation for mm-hmm. all people mm-hmm. of color. You just have to be true to the story that you're trying to tell. And then for myself, I feel like the thing you'll often see in my work that hair is is the thing that I spend the most time on. And that's just a personal preference. I like rendering hair, and for me, mm-hmm. I feel like it sells an image. But in regards to making particular choices, perhaps in response to the representation that I've seen elsewhere, I feel like for myself, it's just an opportunity to explore something that I haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. I don't often feel like I'm trying to solve all the issues or trying to say, like, we don't have enough of this, so I'm going to create it. It's more like, this would be really fun, and you know, it would be really nice to make sure that little boys with locks feel like they're represented too. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. A friend of mine posted on Facebook about her little boy who's had locks since he was born and how that was really important to her family. And I remembered that, and I saved it in my vault, and I just brought it out and remembered this is what makes this character feel really special. Yeah, I don't ever try to feel like I'm answering some major call to action. I always get nervous when people say, we need more of this. We need you. I'm like, no, you don't need me. You need food and water. Here's what I can do. I can make you happy with this drawing. That's always terrifying. But I just try to be honest, and I try to be thoughtful about the choices that I make, specifically, mm-hmm. you know, when creating people of color. And I'm always hesitant to draw boys because I don't know boys very well. I've always been more fond of drawing girls since I was a kid, and I feel like a lot of artists will be familiar with this kind of thing. I only drew girls for a really, really long time, mm-hmm. and people ask me all the time, why don't I draw boys? We need more representation of boys. And I just say, I get what you're asking for. I get it. I don't know if I could provide a steady flow of honest material about boys. Because I feel like...
They're black male illustrators.
There are so many illustrators that are out there. And I find it so great that I can go to this person's profile and see really great use of color. I love that I can go to this other person's profile and see really, really great use of mm-hmm. costume design. That I think mm-hmm. there are lots of artists that are out there that I would just like to celebrate as well. I don't want to put it all on any one person's plate.
Yeah, but that's the public. Yeah. As soon as you get a little bit of power, you know you could do.
You solve could. All the problems.
Exactly, with your platform. I can only imagine what, like, Deborah Cartwright gets when they're just like, why don't you show boys jet setting in Europe?
You know, we went to college together.
Get out!
She went to UVA.
What? Mm-hmm. And y'all are both stars now. I'm waiting for her book. Her stuff is so adorable. Love it. I don't know if she's intending for it to be adorable.
With her, I mean, I don't want to talk too much because I haven't chatted with her in a long time, but I'm really good friends with one of her really good friends, and I just know that a lot of her work was inspired by being herself. Mm-hmm. Like, she had a lot of personal thoughts and feelings growing up about her own hair, so she wanted to make work that was about it. And the fact that people identify with that is a beautiful thing, but it's not any one person's role to provide commentary on every little thing, especially Absolutely. You know, especially if you're just trying to express yourself the most raw way that you know how. Uh-huh. A lot of times when I'm drawing, I'm just trying to practice. I'm just trying to see if I can accomplish something. Uh-huh. See if I can accomplish creating this character in the style of Walt Disney. Or see if I can create something that looks like it belongs in this world. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes there's no other intention other than for me to test myself and my ability mm-hmm. to do it. So sometimes it's not a conceptual process. It's, you know, it's a technical thing.
Yeah. And I think writers do that too. Sometimes I'll be like, can I write a flash fiction story in a sentence like Jamaica Kincaid? Mm-hmm. Can I do a braided essay like so-and-so? And in many cases, I cannot. And I should just play to my strengths, which are not those. Well, thank you so much for being on, Vashti. How may people reach out to you, connect to you, buy your stuff, commission you, all that good stuff?
So I am on most platforms as @VashtiHarrison. That's Twitter and Instagram. I have a website, VashtiHarrison.com. There's information about Little Leaders there at VashtiHarrison.com/little-leaders. Mm-hmm. The book is available for pre-order on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
And it's a number one bestseller in a couple categories.
Yeah, it got really boosted up there for a couple of days. But yeah, it's been kind of floating around different categories in the children's history and biographies. So that's really, really exciting.
And wasn't it supposed to come out next year? Like when it was first announced, it was a 2018 book.
Yeah, it was first announced for January 2018 and then got moved up to December 2017. Mm-hmm. So not too huge of a jump, but regardless of those 2 months, it was always going to be a crashed title. So when we signed the deal in March, we knew that we were just going to have to hit the ground running. I would have to finish all the writing and finish all the artwork immediately. But it is available for pre-order and the links are on my website.
And I'll be sharing them leading up to and after the date of release, December 5th.
I want to do like an AMA, maybe like on Instagram.
Oh, that'd be cool. The day of, you mean?
Nah, I don't know. Anytime. I hadn't thought about that.
And this is the perfect book for your... I don't think it's just for kids, in all honesty. Like, I'm keeping my copy and buying other people.
I made all of these choices because I wanted it to be a really beautiful book. So yeah. I love great art objects, and I wanted this thing to be something that you would want to keep around on your coffee table. Yes. So not just for kids.
No. And also, that's also something else I've been noticing a lot of people, like, I'm getting it for my girls, which I think is fantastic. I also think it's good for boys and non-binary. Last question. Do you foresee another Little Leaders?
Yes, we are already working on book two. It was a really tough process to be able to choose a list of only 40 women for this book. Mm-hmm. That's why there's this extras section, the other connections that I wanted to make and the people who, you know, I just couldn't give up a spot for all of them. So there is going to be another book and I have no idea when that's supposed to be released, but I'm working on it now.
And it's going to be more black women.
It's going to be women from around the world.
Oh, wow. That'll be in the near future. Meanwhile, also, is it okay to use the hashtag Little Leaders?
Yes.
Use the hashtag Little Leaders. Buy the book. By the time this episode airs, the book will be out. So you should definitely buy it. Talk about it. Spread the love. Talk about where it is. Tag it. Tag Vashti.
Yeah. You can ask me questions. You can send me any questions through the links on my website.
Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much, Jen.
And thank you for listening. Once again, you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub.